Welcome to Dear Culture, the podcast that gives you news you can trust for the culture. I'm your co-host, Jaron Keith Gaynor, managing editor at TheGrio.com.
And I'm your co-host, Shauna Pinnock, social media director at The Grio.
As we all know, Election Day was last week, and the country is still reeling from its aftermath.
That's right, Grio fam. We got our special co-host, Dr. Christina Greer and Dr. Jason Johnson here to unpack and deconstruct exactly what happened last week.
I feel the next 70 days will be this nation moving through that possibility of people having to digest what this is for them. And I think that they're apoplectic because as much as folks gave Obama hell, I think Kamala, listen, look at how he rolled out of nowhere and took down Hillary Clinton in 20 minutes.
Welcome to Dear Culture, the podcast that gives you the news you can trust from the culture. I'm your co-host, Dr. Christina Greer, associate professor of political science at Fordham University and politics editor here at The Grio.
I'm Dr. Jason Johnson, professor of politics and journalism at Morgan State, and I am a co-host and problem maker for Dr. Greer, who is the political editor at The Grio.
Oh, Lord it be. And this week we're asking, Dear Culture, what do the next few weeks look like? All right, Dr. Johnson, here we are. We have survived an election. We lived another day.
Did we survive? Let's not start
if you,
off with
if you let me finish, here. I was going to say survived an election asterisk.
Okay.
We are in for a bumpy road the next 71 days.
Yes.
Lots of people were celebrating the street on Saturday. And I believe in incremental celebrations. As someone, you know this very well as well, someone who's gone through graduate school, you have to celebrate the milestones. You cannot wait until you get to the top of the mountain. Absolutely. It just doesn't make sense mentally, spiritually, physically, right? You have to sort of get out in the streets and dance on a Saturday when the projections say that Joe Biden has won Pennsylvania and Nevada. I, however, have a pit in my stomach because I don't think the president's going to attend the inauguration. I think he's that. Petty LaBelle, Petty Pendergrass, Petty Wop, you name it, right?
Yes.
But the visual of that helicopter flying away on January 20th when we peacefully transferred power, that's the visual I have in my head. I won't be able to rest until we symbolically have that. And I'm worried about, I tend not to worry, but the reason why I have a pit in my stomach is because I tend not to try to interact with insecure people, men especially, desperate people, men especially.
You know, and we're just looking,
racist people.
Very judgmental. Seems exceptionally judgmental.
Like, men especially. And so I feel like we've got this president who is aided and abetted by his party constantly.
And his wife and his kids.
I mean, those grifters. But I just feel like the sense of desperation, it's like a rabid dog who's painted himself, you know, into a corner of a room. And I don't think he's going to go quietly into the night. And I think the difference between 2016 and 2020, and I really want to get your opinion because lots of people are like, oh, extend the olive branch, be kind. We'll get to that in a second. But the difference is in 2016, after the Democrats suffered a loss that they weren't expecting, what did they do? They went home. They knitted some pink hats and they marched in the streets, right?
Yes.
Okay, fine. The difference is in 2020, when the Republicans aren't happy with the results, they are picking up AR-15s, going to courthouses and places and locales where poll workers and poll counters are and demanding they be let in so they can observe or sort of find justice in whatever way they see fit. That's the difference for me. And that's why the celebration feels a touch premature. My grandmother used to always say, there's a lot of slip between cup and lip. Like, I don't like to fully celebrate until it's done, past the finish. Get your mind out the gutter. This is a PG-13 podcast.
I didn't even know what it meant.
I'm trying to drink from the glass, and there's a lot of slip. There's a lot of water that can come out the glass before it touches my lips.
It's not a done deal. I was thinking of slip like the old-fashioned clothing, and I was like, okay, I'm confused. Okay,
It's 2020. You better get yourself together. You better get it together.
Look, I'm still caught up on the fact that you talked about a dog painting itself in a corner. And I just see this dog with like a paintbrush in its paw.
I'm on like 10 hours of sleep for the past week, right? I've been sitting in this chair so much so this chair is about to reel itself just out in the streets of Brooklyn. But I want to ask you specifically, because you've had lots to say about this idea, and we'll get to what are the next few weeks look like. But I want to first tackle this idea that the Democrats should reach across the aisle, proverbially and literally, to embrace people
who for the past 4 years have made it very clear that they don't care about your people or anything that you care about. What do you say to those individuals, Dr. John?
Well, first off, you got to ask who's making the request, right? Who is the person out there saying you all should reach across to the other side? It's generally the people that lost, the very same people who were saying F your feelings when Trump won last time. So the request is not being made by good faith. It's not a good faith offering. That's the first thing. The second thing to take into consideration is, like, you know, there's a difference between not alienating or excoriating people who lost, but also not necessarily compromising your agenda. When Joe Biden said, like, I'm going to work as hard for the people who didn't vote for me, I'm like, nah, Joe, you're supposed to actually work harder for the people who put you in office. That's what representative democracy is supposed to mean. It doesn't mean you ignore the people who didn't vote for you. It doesn't mean that you abuse the people who didn't vote for you. But I'll be damned if I think that anybody who voted for Joe Biden is expecting him to put them on the same plate as people who didn't vote for him, as people who chased Biden-Harris trucks out of Houston, out of Texas, as people who showed up with guns and tried to intimidate voters in different places. So no, I don't buy being nice to nobody. You won, you lost, whatever it is, you deal with the consequences. But I also say this, and I think this is excruciatingly important going forward. You have to understand that the Republicans have made it clear for almost 20 years now. I mean, going all the way back, honestly, to Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, they are operating on a zero-sum game view of politics. Any policy advancement by Democrats is perceived as a loss by Republicans. Yes, yes. A loss. And they don't want to lose.
And so they calcified it during the Obama years when they wouldn't let that man pass a doggone thing. The second he lost unified government after the 2010 midterms, they were like, hey, bruh, guess what?
Right.
Like, you might win re-election, but you're not going to have any election.
You're not going to get anything done. So no, I don't believe in any of that.
And that took Barack Obama forever to realize. I was like, sir, these are not the old white men that your grandfather used to hang out with. They don't care about you, Barry. They don't like you, and they're never going to work with you. Like, you're wasting your time.
This is what Obama didn't realize, which I'm thinking Joe should know better, but probably he doesn't because he's old and he's a white guy and he probably thinks he can be friends with these people. I always faulted Obama, one, for taking almost his entire first term to figure this out, but two, it's because he came out of Illinois where all the fights are basically between Democrats and the Republicans don't really have much power. So I don't think he understood what scorched earth, you know, zero-sum politics worked like.
Yeah.
He figured it out a little bit in his second term, but you would think that Joe Biden, having watched Barack Obama, would learn his lesson, but I don't know. I don't know if you can teach Joe new tricks.
Well, I don't think so. You know why? Because Joe Biden's been a public servant for 47 years, and we get it. But the D.C. that he grew up in is not the D.C. that exists.
Mm-mm.
You know, you've got Mitch McConnell, his former colleague, homeboy, who's just like, nah, we're not going to recognize. We're going to recognize the Senate and the House races, but we're not going to recognize Joe Biden. I mean, he saw it under Barack Obama, but I think he probably has told himself that it's like, oh, because he was young and experienced and revisionist history wasn't that bad. And he's black. Right. It's like, no, those guys are gone. That Washington is gone.
Right.
Right. And I think the reason why he's holding on to Kasich and Romney is because they're the only two Republicans that remotely remind him of the good old days when there was bipartisanship, for better or for worse. Right. These cats, the Lindsay and the Mitches, they don't care.
And the Mitches,
they like power. Mitches, the Mitches,
kind of Mitch made.
That's a new thing. Like when someone's acting a fool and just lying and telling whoppers, it's like, you know what? Stop Mitching. You're being a Mitch, okay?
I Cut said Lindsey Graham is like, I know you may not get this reference, but he's Senator Reek from Game of Thrones. And those who are watching,
what did I just tell you last week? Nobody's talking about Winter's coming. I don't know the show.
Appropriate
reference.
We're
like, ooh, the White Walker.
He's a gelded man. That's what you'll understand.
Okay.
You'll understand what a gelded man.
All right. So for all the listeners, I hope you enjoyed that. For all the people who don't watch Game of Thrones,
I don't know who you
collectively
people are.
We're
in a pandemic, okay? It was basically Tiger King and Game of Thrones. What the hell else did you watch?
Sopranos. A different world. Start to finish.
Sopranos. The Sopranos went off like 15 years ago. Sopranos went off before Dave Chappelle. Sopranos went off before the show.
You know, it's interesting. The last season of The Sopranos is post 9/11. So like they had to deal with that. I mean, that it's fascinating. And then, you know, I always rewatch The Wire, but I need to re-up.
It's not the same Baltimore anymore. I'm just telling you. Half those people are elected officials and the others are retired. Just telling
you. Oh, my. Yeah, well, at some point, a different podcast, we can talk about the new 36-year-old.
We should. We should talk about that. There's actually now a mayor of Baltimore who is like younger than me, which is weird. Yeah.
About it. And he's the youngest mayor. He's 3 months younger than O'Malley was when he got into office. Okay, so Brent Scott, look him up, guys. It'll be curious. He was, you know, he was head of the city council. So, I mean, he's clearly moving and shaking. And then, you know, we've got Woodfin in Alabama. So there's,
how
it's
many
a thing.
People may
it's
end up in the administration. You want to talk about the next 70 something days, because honestly, and this happened with the mayor of Youngstown, I forgot, it was a young black guy who was a couple of years ago with Obama. Unfortunately, many of these African-American public officials, whether they're men or women, they can be in states where, quite frankly, being mayor of your city might be as high as they can go. Yeah. And those are the number one people that you pick, because look, this brother was the mayor of Youngstown. He was not going to beat Tim Ryan. He was never going to be a member of Congress. No black person is going to win statewide, you know, to be a senator in Ohio. Your best bet is to go, you know, join the Obama administration. So we may see a lot of people do that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, think about, you know, it's too soon, but like someone like Cori Bush, right? First black woman just elected to Congress in Missouri, right? They've had black men, but they've never had a black woman. Like, let's be clear. She could be the most talented person in the world. I don't think Missouri is going to have a black female governor.
I don't think anyone ever has. I don't think that's about to happen. Yeah. So, you know, Cori Bush is, you know, if we notice more and more, and this will be the other thing, this is, I think, as a scholar, the next 70 days, and I always tell people, you have to be a bit cautious about like the hot takes that happen right after an election. We're going to take the next 70 days to actually dig through the data, to actually find out what really happened, to debunk some of these things. Oh, black people voted for this. Wait, we got to dig through the data and really find out what happened. I really think we have to recognize now also that we have this completely changed map. The Midwest, the central part of the Midwest, the Rust Belt, where everybody is moving from. Nobody wants to live in Ohio anymore. Nobody wants to live in Missouri anymore. These are places that people are fleeing. These are places that young people, they may go there for college. They may grow up there and go to college, but they're leaving. They're moving.
That arch is magical, I will say. But other than
Is it really a magical arch? Is it a magic arch, Dr. Gray?
I said the arch is magical.
In general. Okay.
I'm just saying,
familiar with the Gateway Arch. Remember, I grew up as a kid when they used to have the McDonald's boat. A whole boat is the only floating McDonald's in the entire planet. Oh. That's what I live.
Huh. So this is what I'm fascinated about. The blue wall on the West Coast, right? We've got Washington, Oregon, California. We've got this blue ceiling that seems like it's shoring up with Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan. You know, we've got the Northeast Corridor, Pennsylvania acting out every now and again.
You know, right?
Virginia seems to be a little slow on the uptick. I mean, listen, don't talk about my people from Philly now, because guess what? They'll cut you. So we've got like a nice little blue corridor. And then shout out to our girl, Stacey Abrams, right? Georgia, as she said a decade ago, why would you leave 16 electoral college votes on the table, people?
Because I didn't want to have to bend over for them. I just didn't want to reach.
Hey, Tom Perez, and now look at, you don't want to just extend your arm, like you just want to be spoon-fed the 16 electoral college votes, right? We've seen the demographics of middle-class African-Americans reverse migration during retirement, right? You can live comfortably. The weather's better. Many people have family. South Carolina, parts of, you know, the Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana corridor. So it's like Georgia makes sense. You can have a major city. If you don't really want a major city, you got a little make it action.
Right? You can live in Savannah City and get big, you can do nice houses and not have to spend an obscene amount of money. Yes.
No. And then we see Latinx and Asian Americans have been migrating to Georgia for years and a lot post-Katrina. So that's 15 years ago was Katrina. And then you've got young people who are like, listen, I actually want to buy a home. They don't want to be like me paying basically $3,000 a month to live in 700 square feet. They're like, nah. Maybe I want to own something. Maybe I actually want to have some space, right? And so you have young people going down there. And don't forget all about the HBCUs and colleges and universities that are there. People are like, I'm in a grown city and I just graduated. I don't need to move back home.
Not like, that I need to advertise Atlantic, because it is like, I lived there. I loved it before the pandemic and Brian Kemp ruined the place. I would go down there all the time. But also you have to recognize that the industries that are growing up in and around the metro Atlanta area have also led to this mass migration. Basically, Cobb County and Maricopa County in Arizona are basically like, you got 200-300 people moving into those counties every single week. 200-300 people moving in every single week.
To say nothing about your boy Tyler Perry, who's basically going to just own
the
Atlanta.
The Marvel movies are filmed down there. Sitcoms are filmed down there. CW shows are filmed down there. So you're bringing in all these different kinds of people. And then because of the tech industry and because you've got universities there, you have people from all over the world who are like, hey, I came here from China to study. I came here from India to study. Why the hell should I leave? I can go live up in Alpharetta, find a wife, husband, whatever it is that you want to do. So yeah, it's grown. And I think the Democrats, you talk about like not leaving, you know, not leaving points on the field, not leaving money on the floor. I think what we also saw, I mean, we can praise Stacey Abrams. We talked about this last week, but also I think it's the recognition that if you find local organizers and activists and give them money, they know what to do. too.
Hello.
And I think the lesson about Georgia that can be learned about North Carolina, that can be learned about some of these other places, is there is somebody in that state, probably Black, who knows what you got to do. And you have to stop feeding money to the same consultant class and the same masters they keep losing.
From Washington, D.C., of course. I mean, like, listen, hey, Jamie Harrison, I think that may have been part of your problem, listening to too many New Yorkers and D.C.ites. And we can have post-mortem in South Carolina. I mean, like, listen, South Carolina is South Carolina. They're not going to elect a Black man statewide. Like, I mean, not a Black Democrat statewide. But I do think, though, that there could have been and should have been a little more. And I don't know if South Carolina has things like the New Georgia Project South, like the Southwest Georgia Project. Yeah. Like, I'm sure they do. I don't know how active, emboldened, and empowered they were in a Jamie Harrison campaign. So maybe we should have him on and ask him.
The weird thing about, we should have Jamie on the show. He's a really, really nice guy. He's great. I think the difficulty there, and you see it with both the numbers, and again, this is what we're talking about as far as like what people really have to evaluate in the next 70 something days, how we're going to survive this, is Lindsey Graham got the same percentage of the vote in 2020 as he got the last time that he ran in 2014, even though he was facing the toughest competition he's ever faced during a presidential election year and a guy who had a crap ton of money. I think there's just a block. Jamie Harrison might be one of the few candidates who can really say in order to win, he had to flip some white voters. He had to flip some white moderates.
Yeah.
And that is excruciatingly difficult to do in a place like South Carolina where everything is so driven by anti-Black racism. I mean, it was just going to be hard for him to do. And quite frankly, all you would have to do is run up and down some of those suburbs outside of Columbia and say, do you want two Black people as your senator?
Nope. Before you even finish the
sentence, you want two Black what? And they were like, hard coffee, pass. No sugar, no cream? They're
going to say no. I'll drink milk. No, here's a question for you. So lots of folks are concerned about what the next few weeks look like, right? So ideally, we would certify these elections and state houses on December 14th. We've got this Georgia runoff, which is massive because we've got 48 Democrats in the Senate, 48 Republicans in the Senate right now, two independents, and then two races in Georgia, right? Ultimately, one of the
Joe Manchin, so we can't really trust his ass.
As you all know. Yeah, but you'll have to run again because, you know, in each state with the two senators, they need to be off cycle. So this year they're on cycle, so someone else is going to have to run again, which could, in 2 years, we could be right back at this conversation to what's going to happen. So all of a sudden, all eyes are on Georgia because they literally hold the Senate in balance, right? They are the deciders, as George Bush liked to say, as to whether or not Mitch McConnell will be in charge or someone like Chuck Schumer, presumably, would be in charge. And if and when there's a tie, guess who would be the tiebreaker? Vice President Kamala Harris. And so I think, Jason, and tell me, you know, I've never been wrong before.
Anytime I've ever suggested so, you hit me with a neuralizer and I don't remember anymore. So it's just kind of weird.
You and these references. Who used the neuralizer?
That's not a Spider-Man or something. That's a Men in Black reference. The terrible Will Smith movie that made too much cash and it kept making sequels.
Yeah, that's all like the pug, right?
They were horrible film. Horrible.
Okay. Get back to politics. Tommy Lee Jones was Al Gore's roommate at Harvard.
I do remember that. That's where he got the idea. Fugitive.
Oh. One day I'll tell you about my story about the Gore family and my grandfather in Tennessee.
Story about the Gore family that I know. I'll tell you my Gore story.
So yeah, we should just have a whole episode where I just talk about shady politicians and their families, why it is that I have personal grudges. Yeah. This is Al Gore's father, who was a senator from Tennessee. And P.S., don't forget, in 2000, Al Gore did not win Tennessee.
Couldn't even win his people.
Bush v. Gore, the court case. Win your home state, homie. Yes. When your home state.
I don't even think Tipper voted
so,
for
him. So, as I was saying before.
I was at that convention. Were you at the convention?
Tipper was a touch out to lunch.
I will never forget.
No, she was a touch out to lunch.
Hold on. I have to, I remember the question, but I got to tell you this story. I'm at the 2000 convention. I'm a kid. I'm so excited to be there. I'm at the 2000 convention. I will never forget. And it's not like you can't predict this. Hey, my parents are divorced, so maybe I could just see it coming, right? On the night where he gets the nomination, and he
that
was in LA.
Was where? That convention was,
that was in LA.
New York. Okay.
And it was in the Staples Center in LA. And I remember they were giving like free massages to like press people. So I was there. I was like, oh, I got like a free massage and everything. It was like there was some internet, but not a lot of internet. Anyway, so I remember that night. So Al Gore gets up.
And whenever I say that, my students look at me like, they're like, wait, what? Insane. I'm like, there was no internet. And they're like, what do you mean there's no internet? I was like, there's no internet, people. They're like, how'd you look things up?
It was called an encyclopedia
parents. Right. Telling you
why. So I'm at the convention. Everybody's all excited and thrilled, whatever. So he gets the nomination. nation. And everybody's all excited, they share. And I remember he goes, we have to find this video. We can integrate this video, right? He reaches over to like kiss his wife. He reaches over to kiss Tipper Gore. First off, her reaction is like, is it Thursday? Like, I mean, she's completely lost that he's trying to like slob her down like it's the end of World War II. And then second, it was the most uncomfortable. It was like Iman and Michael Jackson in the Remember the Time uncomfortable.
Oh, yes. That Remember the Time video, that like, tongue. Oh, that kiss.
I saw it like every child of divorce was watching. I was like, oh, this won't last.
Well, listen, it's like the cover of Essence. Be on the cover of Essence as
a child.
So, I mean, Al Gore, I find the Gores and the Clintons fascinating because they're of the same generation, but they represent like sort of old school grandparents. It's like, we hate each other, but we'll never get divorced. And then the Gores represent so the latter 20th century, you know, politicking and marriages. It's like, we don't like each other. We're young enough. Let's just call it quits.
I mean, Tipper Gore, I'm sure she's living fine. Al Gore is living fine. He invented the internet. I'm sure you're getting residuals from that. Everybody went on with their existence. But yes, the Clintons, like, quite frankly, this isn't gossip. This is the political part about it that I think you're pointing out. Like, even though they're from the same generation, I honestly believe, and I thought this back in 2016, I was like, if somebody could go back in time to like 1981, when Bill Clinton was doing all those shenanigans and he first became governor, if somebody had told Hillary Clinton in 1981, you know what, Hillary?
Girl, you better leave him. Years,
you will be able
save to yourself.
This man and pursue your own career, and you might actually be more successful. She'd have left him, but she was from a generation where she thought, I can't get where I want to get if I don't stay with my husband.
No, of course not. And we still have those conversations as women in success. And that's why I think, you know, this is, I don't know if we'll have time to get to this today, but I think that that's why some of these folks are so apoplectic about this Biden-Harris ticket and why they're being so obstructionist. Because I think that it's less about Joe Biden. I think it's more about Kamala Harris. And they're looking at Joe Biden. It's like, this dude's going to be 78 when he's sworn in. That means this Black woman, this Indian woman, this child of immigrants, this woman who has a Jewish husband, this woman who has chosen not to have children, right? This powerful woman could be the leader of the free world. And these men have never had a female boss. They've never had a boss of color. They've never had a female boss of color. And I think that they cannot accept. I think that they can accept Joe Biden. I mean, they know Joe Biden. Joe Biden's like, he's that guy. And that's why I think he's the guy for the moment too. And if there is someone who can try and unify, it is Joe Biden. And I respect him. And I think also as families suffer losses from coronavirus.
He gets it.
Joe Biden can hit that tone.
There's a Black woman on the coronavirus committee. Like, you understand.
Like, look, co-chair of the coronavirus. He said, and Black people are disproportionately affected, I got to make sure that like they are not lost in the shuffle. I mean, this is a man who understands. When he looks you in the eye and he says, I know you lost your mother to coronavirus. He's looking you in the eye like, I know what anguish feels like. And my policy, you know, he always says, you know, your budget is a moral document. Your policies are a moral. So like, I believe that. And I'm not a whole like, oh my God, I don't like Joe Biden. But like, let's be clear. He is the man for the moment. And I respect that. I think part of the reticence we're seeing, part of these Republicans who are like, they're stealing, like, we don't care if it's coup. We will not accept it. I think it's not about Biden. I think it's what the loud part, that Trump started saying, you know, the last 2 weeks of his tour before the campaign. He's like, do you want Kamala to be in charge? He always says the quiet part loud. And I think that's when it was sort of dawning on him and his people. It's like this Black Asian woman and her Jewish husband. I think all these, because you know they're anti-Semites. You know they're anti-immigrant. You know they're anti-Black.
Anti-woman.
You know they're anti a whole bunch of stuff. And anti-woman, and she's a woman who has chosen not to have children, right? So she has agency over her body in ways that they cannot accept, aka Amy Coney Barrett, right? Aka the 200 justices you put all across the country who are anti-choice, right? Bump pro-life. Ain't no such thing as pro-life. Either you're pro-choice or you're anti-choice. And all these justices and these right-wing loons are anti-choice. They're saying that a woman cannot make a choice for herself about her own reproductive right. I'm supposed to just wake up and give my ovaries to my husband and my daddy, right?
It's like during that's the wedding ceremony. You didn't remember that part? It's like right there. You give your vows, and then you
and right. And if your dad's passed away, you don't have a husband. It's like, well, Jason, I've known for many years. Jason, will you hold my ovaries for me, please? Because you're in charge. So, but you know, and I think that's what I feel the next 70 days will be, this nation moving through that possibility of people having to digest what this is for them. And I think that they're apoplectic, because as much as folks gave Obama hell, I think
Kamala,
listen, look at how he rolled out of nowhere and took down Hillary Clinton in 20 minutes. Like, let's just be honest. She had way more credentials. She had a head start. There are a whole bunch of things where it's like, we took a chance on a 44-year-old dude who was like, hey, I've been in the Senate for five minutes, but I want to be president.
44-year-old black guy who had a paper-thin resume and a middle name that was associated with the greatest terrorist that America had ever known. As we have learned, and as we have to be reminded, and as we're going to be reminding people as we go through the next 70 days, we talked about this morning. It also was because the Clintons pissed off black people.
Hey, we're going on our piss off black people tour 2007-2008. Let's say sneaky racist things.
They made bad mac and cheese. They pulled people's hair. They insulted Jesse Jackson. They insulted Barack Obama. They did everything they could to alienate whatever goodwill they had created for black people. So, what are you gonna do?
Yeah, that's on them. I mean, literally, that's on them. But I think it is interesting, like, you know, in that debate when Barack says to Hillary, oh, you're likable enough. And, you know, like, women felt that. It's like, I wasn't even a huge, you know, sort of Hillary Clinton fan at the time, but I was like, dude, you're being like a bro dude right now. And I know exactly what you're saying, right? And this, so she's and like the brain guy, girl because I was like, cool guy. Because you're a guy.
So I read that different because to me, I read that as all the crap, that was like all the nastiness of the campaign because the Clintons had just been so crappy to him. I mean, really, remember, this is the lady who suggested that he might be assassinated. Remember that? Like she's...
Oh no, listen, they were fully... out of pocket. You know why? Because guess what? Going back to our earlier point, they were desperate. And this is what makes me so nervous about this moment. It's like, we see what white people are capable of in a political space when they're desperate. And that looks like small potatoes compared to this. You know, because like Donald Trump will forever be a loser, right? And in the 21st century, he's the first president in the 21st century who's an incumbent, who lost. He's a one-termer.
Can we put that Venn diagram up? That Venn diagram up. It's a beautiful Venn diagram. He's one of only three presidents out of the 46 that we've had who was a one-termer and impeached and what else was it? And lost the popular vote. There's only like three people.
Lost popular vote.
And you got to go back to those like mediocre presidents of like the late 19th century in order to catch the other one.
I mean, it's like Calvin Coolidge. He's like, what? I mean, but that's the thing. And this is why I do think that he'll leave. I think that he's going to sell the country for parts. I think that he's going to tell her secrets. I mean, they're doing it now because I saw the Arab Emirates deal yesterday for $10 billion, like without congressional approval. And it's like, well, where are those weapons going to go?
Yeah.
Right. And to whom ultimately? Like, so I think he's just going to like, what happened to my poor 1994 Toyota Camry when I had to get rid of it? I'm still really upset. Right. But like they sold it for parts, right? I sold it to a guy. And the blue book value was $173. He gave me $500 because he's like, I'm just going to give you a flat rate, right? And then he picked it apart and made good money. I think that's what the president's going to do with this country. I think he'll ultimately leave, but it's the damage he's going to do, not just internationally and sort of with secrets and with money, but also keeping that red base hungry. Like they are walking around with AR-15s. Like I want, like they're trigger happy. Like they want something. They want to sort of say like Joe Biden's illegitimate. And I mean, we've seen they're not afraid of
Remember that because terrorists always go after their own people first. I've always said this about it's Al Qaeda. It's basic, you know, terrorist philosophy. You actually go after your own people first who are not committed, and then you intimidate them so that they don't intervene, and then you go after your actual victims. That's why Al Qaeda kills a lot more Muslims. They don't want to kill Muslims, but they know the vast majority of Muslims don't agree with them. But if they make themselves dangerous, it'll be like, hey, we don't want to deal with you, and then they can go straight for Christians.
Yeah, hands
off. And then they can go straight for white people who are there.
Right.
I agree with you in a weird sort of twisted way. As horrific as COVID is, the fact that Senator Harris and President-elect Biden aren't going to be in large crowd situations is actually comforting to me because of COVID, because I don't trust the security situation that we're going to have. And I agree with you. Not only are these people going to be selling secrets and selling information, et cetera, but I also think just from the simple standpoint of transition, right? Like you've had positions, you've been like assistant dean, you've had different science positions in your department. It's nice if the person who teaches the class before you like gives you their syllabus or gives you their information, right?
Right.
I mean, if they're responsible enough to do that. And if Trump's people have their way, they're going to not give anything. And half of them are trying to negotiate so they don't end up going to jail anyway. So I suspect it's going to be a mess.
Now, I got a question for you because, and shout out, I have no
idea. I thought you were one point.
Administration. I'm associate chair. Yeah, but here's the thing. Administration, it's like herding drunk cats in academia.
Stop feeding them liquor. Stop feeding the cats liquor. If you didn't feed the cats liquor, you wouldn't have this problem.
I love the students
politics, but I am not interested in trying to corral faculty at all. Being chair is enough. But I had a question about, you know, the question this week, dear culture, what do the next few weeks look like? Part of, I think, this reticence also to have this transition begin. And, you know, they are questioning, like, you know, in 2000, when we had a delayed transition, they were wondering if that gap in time made us vulnerable to what ended up happening 9 months later on September 11th, right? So we should be paying attention to this transition. My question for you, though, Jason, do you think part of it, you know, we know it's races and they're nutty and all that, all the things, but is it also because the gross incompetence of some of these people? It's like, what are we transferring? Like, we haven't been keeping the files that legally were like, okay, we're supposed to have a transition, but like, we actually haven't been doing the job that we know by law.
That is 100,000% of it, Dr. Greer. And I'm glad that you made that point, because if we go back to the very, very beginning of the people who put Trump up to this, Russia or whatever, when you look at Steve Bannon, in every single speech, Steve Bannon, going back to 2014, every speech Steve Bannon always gives is that his goal and the goal of the alt-right and the new white power movement across the globe was the destruction of the state. They wanted to tear the state down. That's why those far left intercept type folks sometimes can agree with them, because they want to tear down the state. That's where you get your horseshoe theory from. And again, I'm not attacking everybody who works at the intercept. I'm just talking about sometimes people on the far left. But what I'm saying is the destruction of the state over the last 4 years. I mean, we stopped talking about this around 2017, 2018, but there were dozens of agencies that just never got agency heads, that never got directors. What, we got like 2 years without having a secretary of the Navy? And so there are lots of offices that nobody was ever in. So you're right.
Or people just weren't confirmed. And it's like, well, just kick it here, you know, do your thing. We'll sort of circle back. But I mean, because the thing is, this is what made me really think about it, Jason. And everyone's joking about it. But, you know, as political scientists, I'm like, that whole, we were supposed to be at the Four Seasons, but now we're at Four Seasons Landscaping. And yes, you did just spit out your juice. And I'm sorry, I should have waited until you were done drinking. But here's the thing, though. That level of incompetence. We know that he's got like college seniors in.
Oh, he's got them as Supreme Court justices and stuff. I mean, they're, you know, all of his judges were like 8 years old.
And also all of their colleagues and universities and the American Bar Association were like, this person is literally off the street. Like, what are you talking about? Like, they came in the courthouse to like quickly use the bathroom. Like, hey, you want to be judged for life? Okay. So like, that's where we are right now. Yeah, you know, you're good. No, you're good. I mean, like the fact that Amy Coney Barrett couldn't list the five principles of the First Amendment, you are a Supreme Court justice, and you can't list.
Ben Carson couldn't name the five food groups.
Hey, I didn't say Ben Carson couldn't name the
five
Amendment.
Food groups, I mean, and he thought the pyramids were grain silos. So it's not like anybody that they.
Well, maybe we should have a little quick moment of silence prayer for Ben Carson and hope that his fate isn't Herman Cain's, because we also saw that the pastor, the black pastor, who was at the celebration. Well, RIP. Okay. So clearly this administration does not care about people on coronavirus, and they really don't care about black people. But my question was, these people,
what happens with all of these incompetent people who are in positions that they never really filled? I think what's going to end up happening, and this is the thing, we were talking about this in the beginning.
Like, is there anything to transfer? That's my transfer. Question.
And quite frankly, I used to use this example because this happened when Obama came in after Bush, right? I always say Bush was so happy to be out of that job. He was so, because he didn't want to work anymore. He was like, here, take him.
Yeah. He didn't want to get reelected. And it was just the ego of Dick Cheney that was like, dude, really you're
just
doing like, this job.
It was just about his daddy. And once he made his daddy happy, he didn't have a second term thing, right?
Jason, as I have said several times to you and a few times on this podcast, whenever my students are like, oh, Professor Greer, why don't you run for it? You know, they don't know. They're like, you should be president, of course, right? First of all, I am over 35. So yes, I can technically be president. I'm a U.S. citizen, all these other things. But I always tell them, you know why I cannot be president? Has nothing. I was like, you all think it's because I'm a black woman. And that's why I'm saying I cannot be president. I was like, I'm telling you, I cannot be president because I don't have crippling daddy issues. Like, my dad and I actually are mad cool. I lived with him for 6 weeks this summer. You know that, during coronavirus. Like, we had a great time. We're an odd couple, but you know, we had a great time. Little rum, little cigars, little wine at the end of the evening, right? I don't have crippling daddy issues. So Donald Trump, Barack Hussein Obama, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George H.W. Bush, Prescott was a number, okay? Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, God bless. Like, that peanut farm, there's some things that went down, right? So like all these
things George Washington,
I don't have crippling daddy issues.
But Biden doesn't do, I haven't heard any weird daddy issues. Biden always says nice stories.
No, he doesn't. He might be the first to break the mold because he talks about his dad. You know, sort of.
I don't know.
Because I feel like, let's also be clear though. Joe Biden's been a public servant for 47 years.
Harris he has crafted didn't even mention his narrative, her father right? during her speech, so we know. So
hey, isn't he alive president. And down the street? Like, isn't he alive basically. And down the street?
And he talks smack
like,
about
he's
her.
Not dead, right? Yeah. So I mean, hey, listen. She's gonna follow the mold. Joe Biden, though, I think if we're really clear, though, like maybe his dad
he's
was so awesome.
Old,
I
may not so, remember his dad,
right? But so. He's also been a public servant, so he's been able to craft the narrative of like, hey, he talks right. about when his dad didn't have a job and he's got a gaggle of kids. I'm sure his dad wasn't like, hey, son, I'm just gonna sit on the edge of the bed so we can like shoot the breeze when I got five kids, seven kids, like 7 mouths to feed, and I'm just like gonna kick it with you and like talk about school.
That is extremely.
In 1930s,
and quite frankly, like Joe Biden has been a father for so long. I mean, like he was a single father. Like he was a single dad raising kids in the 70s at 30 years old. So if there's anyone who probably has resolved their daddy issues, it's probably Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Now I'm worried. Yeah. Like I said, it's like a comedian who gets therapy. They lose all their sense. We have an emotionally healthy president. We might be in trouble.
You know, right. I feel like a comedian who gets a lot of money.
Hey, so when we're all eating caviar.
That happened to Jamie Foxx.
Like, you know, when Kevin Hart.
He used to be so funny, but once he got rich.
No, what about Kevin Hart? Kevin Hart had all, I tried to watch one of his specials and he's like literally talking about how long his driveway was and how dark it was because the lights didn't come on my driveway. So then I was driving again and my Ferrari broke down on my driveway. And then I had to call the butlers to come and get me because it was so dark. I was like,
the last time I was paying attention to Kevin Hart is when he was joking about having a checking and a savings and how he couldn't hang out with Shaq. So that was the Kevin Hart that I paid attention to. The super rich Kevin Hart, well, I don't really know, but like, they can't be funny. They can't be funny once they're rich and or happy.
So
Eminem lost it when he got therapy too and got off drugs.
Oh, well, we are proponents here of people getting off drugs. If they
and Lil Wayne.
Oh, and Lil Wayne. Oh, Lil Wayne.
Well, I mean, he got Lil Wayne. Is he really healthy?
Hey, P.S. And guess what? This is the same Lil Wayne who said, I don't have to support Black Lives Matter because I'm rich. I was like, sir, 5 years ago, weren't you just in court because you didn't know where any of your money was and you've been working since you were 10 years old? So let's slow down I'm rich piece because something tells me you haven't read a contract ever and you have no idea whether you're rich or not. Yeah, just because Lambos show up at your house, you don't even know if you own the house. So slow
he was
down
on some good cushion alcohol.
Didn't ASAP Rocky?
He didn't have any down lawyers he could call.
Yeah, well, so stay off the lien, sir.
Right.
Like, stay it off. And check your books. I'm giving you free tax advice.
Does he strike you as a reader? Does he really? Does he strike you as the kind of guy who's asking his accountant?
I don't know, but I do love his use of vocabulary. I mean, I do love his use of vocabulary.
He probably keeps his account numbers in his tats. Like, it was like, this is a bank account, this is ATM. We can't run into people during the pandemic.
Listen, this is also, I do feel protected, like, you know, not with all the crazies in the world. So, like, I do feel good talking about politics because I'm, you know, in the safety of my own home. But it's like, you know, I am talking mad smack about, like, I want to just put hot water and soap on all these ignorant people talking about. Okay, so Jason, I don't know. We've got to check our files. This may be our last pop-up podcast, Dear Culture. Today, we were asking, where do we go the next few days? Or weeks, but
yes,
we'll talk to the powers.
I'm having fun. And it's like, you all don't realize, it's not like Dr. Greer and I don't talk, but see, when we get to put our talk, this is so much less profane than when we talk on the phone. So it's really like, it's like the radio clean version of our actual conversation.
This, yeah, exactly. We're the, like, back in the day when you get the CDs from Walmart. Oh, my mother got me, like, Wu-Tang's first album.
You get, like, 10 for, like, 12 cents or something?
Yeah, no, she got me Wu-Tang's album from Walmart just as, like, a yay! And I was like, oh, this is amazing! Except for the fact that she picked up the clean version. So it sounded like the CD was skipping. Every curse word, they would just... And so it was just like, this is terrible, Mom. Like, the CD is skipping. And then I was like, oh, wait.
Right.
It's for the PG-13 crowd. Okay, so, Dear Culture podcast listeners, we have thoroughly enjoyed you. We may or may not be back. This is like, we're basically Donald Trump right now. It's like, hey,
we
may be back in a week. We may not.
We're not even going to give, we're not going to give any of our editors the files. We're just going to keep them to ourselves to the new one.
Yeah. You'll see. It's a surprise. But until then, be safe, wear a mask. I'm Christina Greer here with Jason Johnson. We are the politics contributors and editors at The Griot. Thank you so much for listening to the Dear Culture podcast, and we shall see you when
we see everybody.
We want to remind our listeners to support their local Black businesses and donate to your local organizations and religious institutions. The business that we will highlight this week is Bee Bomb Book Club. An online children's bookstore, Bee Bomb Book Club is dedicated to the development of infants, literacy for children, education, and self-acceptance. You can visit them at bebombbookclub.com. That's B-E-B-O-M-B bookclub.com. The Griot has published a list of 50 plus Black businesses to support during the coronavirus pandemic. If you'd like your business to be featured, please email us at info@thegriot.com. That's G-R-I-O.com.
As always, thank you for listening to Dear Culture. If you like what you heard, and we hope you did, please give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts and share it with everyone you know.
Please email all questions, suggestions, and compliments to podcast@thegriot.com. The Dear Culture podcast is brought to you by The Griot, executive produced by Blue Talusma, and co-produced by Sundis Hassan, Kyrie Williams, and Kevin Y. Brown.